Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today we are having a public hearing on SJR 15. We have two work sessions. To my understanding, on SB 411, we are not going to be able to move that bill today because it is needing some additional work. Apparently, some amendments are still in the process.
Mr. Chairman, it's a committee, and we don't have the fiscals. There are five amendments, one probably additional one coming. I got the amendments yesterday, and there's no way that the legislative fiscal could come around that quickly.
All right. And regarding SB 95, my understanding is we're ready to go, but we're still waiting on the fiscals. And so we're hoping, as they have in the past, they will show up before we get concluded. So we are going to start with the public hearing. So I open a public hearing on SJR 15.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR 15 comes to you from the Senate Intercommittee on the Judiciary. What I have set forth in the staff measure summary is the original language of Section 15, Article 1 of the Constitution, enacted in 1859. Laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on the principles of reformation and not on vindictive justice. In 2005, referred to the voters, and voters adopt, actually, that's a typo, it should be earlier than that, adopt the current version of Section 1, Section 15, Article 1, which reads as follows: Laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on the principles of protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation. SJR 15 would change that language to read, laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on the principles of protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation, too, may not be founded on the principles of vindictive justice.
All right. What we're going to do, I've looked at the number of people who have signed up. We have, looks like, approximately 9 or 10. I'm going to break these into panels. We're going to do a panel of proponents, and then a panel of opponents, and we'll alternate back, and then if there's other people here that have not signed up, we'll take the testimony after that. So the first panel I will call up will be Arlen Byrd and Dan Bryant.
Thank you. Good morning. Everybody. My name is Arlen Byrd, and I'm here representing myself as a survivor of violence and somebody who is really supportive of the opportunities that are inherent in this bill. I want to first make sure that you all have received the letter addressed to Chair Prozanski that was signed by myself and other survivors, organizations that are supportive of this legislation. Some of us are individuals, murder victims, family members, people who have personally survived violence and crime, and then also organizations that care about this issue. So I want to share a little bit about my personal perspective on this particular bill. We have come together for the opportunity inherent in this amendment to strengthen our criminal justice system's principles of protection of society, personal responsibility, reformation, and accountability. As a survivor of violent crime, I am keenly interested in our criminal justice system and the principles that guide responses to crime, because how we respond to crime is vitally important in preventing what happened to me and the other crime survivors before you from happening again. This amendment helps to strengthen the existing principles in our Constitution to create common understanding. 18 years ago, my sister and I were injured in a car crash that was caused by a man who had too much to drink and chose to drive. As you can see, the crash paralyzed me, and my sister now lives with the effects of a mild traumatic head injury. His choices that evening have changed my life forever. I have now become an advocate for crime survivors and for a system that prevents further victimization. Through the 15 years that I have worked with crime and trauma survivors, I've learned that our system works to bring justice and prevent victimization when the principles of personal responsibility and accountability are upheld. True accountability manifests when an individual accepts personal responsibility for the harm they have created and is able to understand the depth and breadth of harm in the lives of their victims. I've witnessed and experienced some of the ways that accountability can manifest, including how restitution brings meaningful recompense for what was lost in crime. As much as possible, the system must work to help people who caused harm make direct connections between the choices that they've made and the people who were harmed by their actions. This amendment helps to clarify the depth of the principles that exist in Oregon's Constitution. These principles also facilitate the system's ability to prioritize support for victims after crime. Energy Saved, focusing on accountability, protection of society, personal responsibility and reformation, and not vindictive justice, allows precious resources to also be devoted for support services for crime survivors. Services such as domestic violence shelters, counseling, physical therapy, sexual assault advocates, and medical care are among the many critical resources crime victims need. These resources must be adequately funded so that each victim and ultimately justice is served. Our criminal justice system is at its most basic level. It must work to ensure the protection of society. And at best, the programs and policies that make up our system must work to create safe and vibrant communities. This amendment helps to clarify and strengthen the system's ability to do just that, and I urge your support. Thanks very much for listening to my testimony, and I welcome whatever questions you may have.
All right, we'll first hear from Reverend Bryant, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Chair Posansky, members of the committee. I am Reverend Dan Bryant, Senior Minister at First Christian Church in Eugene, privileged to be here with Arwen. I've long respected her work for many years. I come here today not so much in my professional capacity as in a personal one. Like Arwen, I too am a victim, or my mother, who was murdered in 1998, brutally murdered with a kitchen knife. And it's out of that story that compels me to come, because I feel it's absolutely essential that you hear from families such as ours who feel that this is a very important issue. From my religious training, I can say that I feel strongly that vindictive justice is plainly morally wrong. It is a cancer that eats at the soul of individuals as well as societies. It's contrary to the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount when he said, "You've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." And even that notion of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, I learned from a good rabbi friend, which is found in the Torah, is also contrary to the notion of vindictive justice, though it has often been wrongly used to justify notions of vindictive justice. My friend told me that throughout most of history, the rabbis have interpreted that statement not literally, but as requiring a person to properly compensate someone that they had harmed as a form of restitution. Historically, we see the impact of vindictive justice on a society, in examples such as the Treaty of Versailles, which contributed to the rise of fascism, and contrast that to the Marshall Plan after World War II that contributed to the rise of democracy. We saw it at work when a Sikh gentleman in Arizona was murdered after September 11th because someone thought he looked like a Muslim and was acting out of that spirit of vindictiveness. Ultimately, what we seek, and contrast that to the incredible interfaith work that is happening in our community, where Muslims and Jews and Christians and Buddhists and Hindus and Sikhs are coming together in a new spirit of interfaith cooperation. Ultimately, what we seek as family members is that which enables us to heal as victims. My own healing began when I sought to understand what my mother would want. And all you have to know is that she loved the man who killed her. He was a mentally ill nephew, and she came to help him in a time of need. Unfortunately, it was the wrong choice. Well, what concerns me most is it's that spirit of vindictiveness that has increased the prison sentences and has dramatically increased the cost of our society to lock people up for long periods of time that takes away critically needed resources precisely to assist people like my cousin in his time of need. And because there was no other assistance there, my mother paid the ultimate price for it. So I seek this resolution. resolution, ask for your support for this resolution, because I believe that our Constitution should reflect the values that we hold as a society, and we should make it clear that vindictive justice is not one of them. And instead, we should stand for those principles of protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation. I urge you to support SJR 15. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. And also, just to for the record, Dan Bryant is also the cousin of Neil Bryant, who served in this chamber.
He was the chair of this committee.
Yes. So with that, questions or comments for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to be Steve Dole, D.D. Coons, and John Foote. Good morning. I'm not sure who wants to lead off, but whoever would like to start.
Hi. John is going to lead.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for listening to our comments today. My name is John Foote. I'm the district attorney in Clackamas County and have been in public safety for about 30 years. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association and the chiefs of police, both of whom oppose this SJR 15. And I would like to explain a little bit why. And it really has nothing to do with being in favor of vindictive justice. It's one of those odd situations you find yourself in. And let me explain. I've handed out to you copies of the appropriate parts of the Oregon Constitution as well as that apply here, as well as the voters' pamphlet from 1996, which was, in fact, the year that the voters passed this measure changing this provision by a 66%, as I understand it. Steve Dole will talk about that more, but by a wide margin. I'm really here out of respect for Bob and Dede Coons and Steve and the work they've done. This change in this constitutional measure was done as really part of a culmination of 20 years of work to change the culture around victims in this state. I know it was personally very important to Bob Coons, who has now passed away and can't be here today. He felt that the provisions, as they stood before, simply just weren't balanced enough. So I'm here out of respect for them and know how much this means to them. And I think you all know how much they've done personally. When I think about the amount of work that they have done, along with Steve, never being paid a dime, to change how victims are treated in this state, it's really a remarkable story. And the comments in the voters' pamphlet, I think, make good reading for what the reason was at the time. Now, finally, I'd like to just, I'm going to do something that only a desperate lawyer does. I'm pulling out a dictionary because vindictive justice, in my mind, is an oxymoron. It doesn't really belong anywhere. That's a rhetorical figure in which incongruous or contradictory terms are combined. That's what an oxymoron is. Let me read the definition out of American Heritage for Justice. It's the quality of being just or fair, the principle of moral rightness or equity, the upholding of what is just, fair treatment and due reward in accordance with honor, standards, or law. And now let me read the definition of vindictiveness. Disposed to seek revenge or vengeful, intended to cause pain or harm, spiteful. And I just don't think they go together. This phrase was created in 1859 when we had a very different system of justice in this state. We had frontier justice. The protections that are in the constitutional provisions that I've showed you today really hadn't been fleshed out by the courts. There were no protections for defendants the way there are today. So perhaps vindictive justice had some meaning back then when you just took somebody out behind the corral and hooked them up and ended it. We don't do that anymore. So there's just no place for that in our society, and it's an oxymoron, and it really hurts the people who've done so much to chain victims' rights in the states. That's really the bottom line for me. So, thank you.
Senator Prozaski and members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity. John said much of what I was going to say, but I...
Dee, I need you to...
I want to tell you why... Pardon?
You need to put your name on the record first.
Oh, I'm Dee Dee Koontz.
Thank you.
I live in Clackamas County. I was one of the founders. My husband and I were the founders of the organization Crime Victims United, which really started in a large way a organization that was for crime victims. And we soon gathered many members. When Bob was on the, which one was that? That was the Governor's Commission Against Violent Crime in 1984, I believe it was, why he made that proposal for the committee, and somehow it got lost. And I think every session from then on, we had some variation of this. The reason was there was a great deal of confusion on what it meant. As John said, it's an oxymoron. If something is vindictive, it's not justice, and if it's justice, it's not vindictive. And for that reason, many people were confused on how they were supposed to respond to this portion of our Constitution. We tried different wording, and we included many, many people of the wording. I believe that you, Senator Prozaski, was one of those people at some later time. And we found that the same people that are proposing, for the most part, are the same people who opposed all of the different wordings that we did. And some people wanted to leave out reformation, and we were absolutely solid on not letting that go. And I have no objection to anything in the Constitution that says we don't torture people. The Constitution has many protections. Our U.S. Constitution has protection. Our state Constitution has protection. We have statutes that are protective. But if that isn't enough, I don't have an objection to saying that we don't waterboard, we don't do bamboo under the fingernails, we don't hang them, we don't do any of those evil things. But the idea to put vindictive justice back into something that has worked so well for so long now, the information coming out of our criminal justice is that crime is down in Oregon tremendously, particularly violent crime. And back in when we started, it was increasing rapidly. I believe in 1986 there were 172 murders in Oregon, and it's gone down much from that with a larger population. There's an old saying that if it ain't broken, don't fix it. And this is not broken the way we worded it. We had input for almost every single solitary person involved in criminal justice. involved in when we did this. By the time we got done, I felt like we had talked to 90% of the state. So please, don't put that confusion back in it. Some people thought Reformation was the only reason, and some people thought that any kind of punishment for crime was vindictive. And we need to have a clear understanding what we're supposed to do when we punish criminals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just for the record, since DD brought up my position in 1995 when the bill was actually on the floor, I did vote for the bill, SJR 32, that went to the voters and that was passed by the voters in 1996. Steve?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Steve Dole from Crime Victims United of Oregon. Laws for the punishment of crimes shall be founded on reformation and not vindictive justice. That's what the Constitution said until 1996. It was changed to say laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on the following principles: protection of society, accountability and responsibility for one's actions, and reformation. There were only two states in the Union prior to that election that had that language of vindictive justice in there: Indiana and Oregon. There was no magic to these words. They weren't written by any great Oregon scholars or great Oregon forefathers. They were lifted from the Indiana Constitution. You could say plagiarized. I don't know why, laziness. I can't tell you why that happened. We turned the statement from a statement of what shouldn't be done to a statement that's proactive, that says what the principles should be founded on and how they should be carried out. Look, I'm not for vindictive justice. I don't know anybody who is for vindictive justice. John said this, I'm going to repeat it. It's an oxymoron, it truly is, and we weren't the first to say that. It was said on the floor of the House of Representatives in 1995 when this debate happened by former Senator Lisa Nato and also his former Commissioner of Multnomah County. She also said, and I looked up in the minutes from the committee hearings, that it's an absolutely absurd phrase. I agree with Lisa Nato completely. We have governors on vindictiveness in this state. They're contained in the Constitution. The most notable one is the same one that's in the United States Constitution that says cruel and unusual punishments shall not be inflicted, but all penalties shall be proportional to the offense. Now, if you're looking for a governor, if you're looking for a prohibition, there it is, Article 1, Section 16. Furthermore, there's one other, Article 1, Section 13, which states no person arrested or confined in jail shall be treated with unnecessary rigor. One more governor on vindictiveness. There were three nays in the Senate when SJR 32 was passed and one in the House. As Dee Dee said, Senator Brzezinski and the current President of the Senate, Peter Courtney, both voted for that bill, as did the current Secretary of State, Kate Brown. I got to be blunt. I think this is a waste of the taxpayers' money and a waste of the taxpayers' time. There's much more important things to be done in this state. 66% of Oregon voters said this is what they wanted their constitution to say, that they wanted it to be proactive and they wanted that language out. Crime Victims United strongly opposes this Senate Joint Resolution. We ask for your no vote. Also, I want to say this, that John Powell, who I talked to this morning, indicated that the Oregon Sheriff's Association would be opposing this bill, and they will take an official position on that after their meeting tonight. Again, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Hang on one second. Questions? Steve, one question regarding the vote. Do you think the voters would have rejected the measure if it would have had something staying in there regarding vindictive justice, if it would have just had at the end, leaving what was originally put in there by the founders, not for vindictive justice? Do you think the voters would have actually turned that down with the changes of the four principles?
Senator, I can't tell you what voters would or wouldn't do, especially 15 years ago. But the point is that discussion was made in this body, and it was debated in the Senate Rules Committee. It was debated in the subcommittee of the Judiciary. Over and over and over, I read the minutes, and I think it was clear to everyone that that did not need to be in there, and that, again, there are other governors. I think Dee Dee might have something that she might like to
add. I just wanted to know if he had a position as to how the voters would have reacted.
Can I just add, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, I think really nobody knows that answer, but I think what wouldn't have happened, it wouldn't have gone on the ballot, because the people that were designing this wanted it out. And the people that were asking for the support of the legislature and the voters, people like Bob and Dee Dee Koons and Steve, wouldn't have proposed it with that language in there. And I think everybody knew that in all of these conversations that Dee Dee and Bob had with people. And that's how it got designed. It got designed really to take it out and it was really part of rebalancing this system for victims, as I said before, and it's a very important symbol to them.
Right.
So, thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
Thank you. We went all over the state with these. We had a motor home, and we did every town and every county and talked to everybody, that every office, every place, including newspapers. And I think that I can say that the people that we talked to had a full understanding of why we were doing it, and they supported why we were doing it. As John and Steve have said, I mean, I can't say what voters, if I was, I would get on the, have a wonderful response at every election. I could tell you ahead of time what you were going to, whether you're going to be elected or not, right? So no one can say that. But my sense is that they certainly understood and supported the ones I talked to, who were many, many, many.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to be Mary Zinkin and Abigail.
Good morning, Senator Pozanski and members of the committee. My name is Mary Zinkin, and I'm very happy to be here to speak this morning. I am here as a crime survivor, as well as the co-founder of the Master's Program in Conflict Resolution at Portland State, and a facilitator of Restorative Justice Dialogues. When I was 16, I read The Crime of Punishment by Carl Menninger. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that book or if it's even still in print. It really resonated with me that there was something that was not helpful about just punishing people, that there was an accountability that needed to happen between people who harmed people and the people they harmed. And then when I was 22, I was really tested in that. I was shot by a person. I still don't know exactly what was going on. He had a sawed-off shotgun, and I was at a convenience mart, and he was trying to kill people, and I was one of the people he tried to kill. And for 35 years, I have reshaped that event, really healed and transformed the wounds from that violence. I think one of the things that I'm hearing is that, you know, it's very difficult to say all crime victims want. We're very, you know, we're individuals, we come from different places, and we have different needs. And I'm very supportive of this adding, you know, keeping the changes that were made to the Constitution that were just referred to make sure that those principles are in place in terms of protection and accountability and reformation. And I also think it is important to add language around non-vindictive justice. I think in my own healing journey, it's important to be able to recognize that there are moments in time when you do feel vindictive, you do feel angry. It's a part of the healing process, and yet it's very important to not have a system of justice that reflects or acts on those principles. Since then, I have, you know, really been created this master's program because I very much believe, again, in that importance of accountability in terms of one's actions. And one of the things that was very telling to me is at the time when I was shot, I was actually working with ex-offenders. I was helping them get into community college to try and help them reenter society and not commit other crimes. And the people that I was working with at the time were very impacted by seeing me as a victim. They themselves had probably done similar things, and yet seeing me and seeing what happened to me had an impact that just solidified for me the importance of bringing that together at some point, if ever possible. That true accountability happens when the person that has caused the harm is in some way understands very clearly what has happened to the person that they've harmed, and that the person who's been harmed understands even more about what, you know, I still am left with questions 35 years later of what happened, you know, what was going on in that particular evening. And so I very much support services for victims. As you can see, once you've been victimized, it doesn't leave you. You keep those injuries. You have the opportunity to heal and transform them, which is what I've dedicated my life to help people be able to do. And I just very much support all of the principles that you've got in this legislation. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Abigail. I live in Silverton in Marion County. I represent several organizations today. I'm active in and I'm a speaker for Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation, Murder Victim Families for Human Rights, and Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. I am the mother of a murdered child. My daughter Catherine was murdered when she was 19 years old. I was led into anger and rage and kept there by the vindictive nature of our criminal justice system. I can tell you that anger and rage, such as I was allowed to get into, is very detrimental both to your body, to your physical health, to your mental health, and your spiritual health. And I got stuck in that anger and rage for years and years. And it wasn't until 12 years after my daughter Catherine was murdered that I was able to get on a path that led me to healing. And that healing came not through harsher sentences or worse treatment for the criminals, but through my own ability to find compassion and forgiveness. Language is important, and language reflects our culture. And I want my grandchildren to be raised and to live in a culture of compassion and forgiveness. I don't want them to live in a culture that immediately jumps into anger and rage and keeps us there forever and ever. As a victim of a murdered, as a mother of a murdered child, there were no services available to me. There was no one to reach out to me. There was no help at all. And I believe that some of the monies that we've been using to keep people in jail and prison longer, harder sentences could certainly be better used to assist the victims of crime, because they have so many needs that at this time are certainly not being met. I've come to believe and to work for restorative justice, and I have seen it work over and over again. And I know that these harsh ways that we treat the criminals although they need to be put somewhere where they can't hurt us anymore. I know that what we do is create another whole group of victims, and those are the families of these men and women who have been put away. We have no help for the victims' families either. And so I just want to thank you again for hearing me and knowing that there are thousands of us who have been victims of serious crimes who do not believe or want vindictive justice. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions or comments for this panel? Thank you very much for coming forward. The last panel I have on the registration sheet will be Doug Beloff and Doug Parkerode.
Chair Prezantsky, honorable senators on the committee. My name is Doug Beloff. I'm a law professor of constitutional criminal procedure, and that's the perspective from which I testify in opposition to this bill. Beginning with the premise that the Oregon Constitution should not be amended lightly, unnecessarily, or against the will of the people, I oppose this resolution. The people removed the reference to vindictive justice with the overwhelming support of both houses of this legislature from the Oregon Constitution in 1996. In constitutional terms, this was a very recent event. The resolution contradicts and disrespects the recent will of the people who voted by a two-thirds majority to remove the language. SJR 15 seeks to reinsert the language. There is no persuasive evidence that the will of the people has experienced a sea change since that time, or that the removal has caused a crisis of constitutional or even statutory dimension. Second, as importantly, the reinsertion of the language is constitutionally unnecessary. The language is a historical anachronism adopted from the Indiana Constitution of 1851. Historically, there was some necessity to affirmatively prohibit vindictive justice. Criminal justice was primitive, there were few professional police, and the nation was in transition from private prosecution to state prosecution. Moreover, 160 years ago, there were inadequate other controls over vindictive justice. For example, the United States Constitution did not apply to the states. For these reasons, in 1851, the language made some sense. Things have changed dramatically and for the better in 160 years. Vindictive justice is unconstitutional under the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution, which now applies to the states and the state of Oregon. Furthermore, here in Oregon, vindictive prosecutorial or judicial behavior resulting in prejudice to a criminal defendant is subject to sanctions of professional ethics. Moreover, the Oregon Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, as well as prohibits unusual rigor for those in the custody of the state. In sum, there is no modern-day need for SJR 15. I suspect, but do not know, that SJR 15 is an attempt to redefine the constitutional framework of existing sentencing laws. My assumption is only strengthened by the testimony of those who have preceded me. If so, it is the wrong vehicle to do so. SJR 15 makes no legal difference whatsoever. The traditional values and constitutionally upheld values for sentencing are incapacitation of the offender, specific deterrence of the offender, general deterrence to other, retribution, also known as just deserts, and rehabilitation, also known as reformation. For example, mandatory minimum sentences and even death sentences are plainly constitutional and within traditional sentencing rationales both under the United States Constitution and the Oregon Constitution. These types of sentences were not judged to be unconstitutionally vindictive before the language was removed from the Oregon Constitution, and these sentences will remain constitutional in the event that SJR 15 becomes law. In other words, SJR 15 will have no legal effect at all on the constitutionality of existing sentencing laws. In sum, in the modern era, SJR 15 presents a patently unnecessary amendment to Oregon's Constitution. There are adequate modern constitutional and legal safeguards from other sources to guard against vindictive justice. The resolution is further unnecessary because it will have no impact on the scope or nature of lawful sentencing under either the United States or Oregon Constitution. Moreover, the people removed it from the Constitution only 15 years ago, and the people's will and this legislature's will should be respected. There have been many voices raised in recent years about Oregon constitutional amendments which are ill-conceived and unnecessary. This proposed amendment is one of them. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I'm a retired Lane County District Attorney. I agree with everything that Professor Ballouf said, and shall not repeat any of that. I want to make only one point here. The point I wish to make is the Constitution in this area, Article 1, Section 15, right now, is positive. It tells us what the punishment of crime shall be based on. It does not list all of the negatives that we shouldn't be using. We should not go back to the negatives, because once you start down that road of listing those, what else gets on the list? We certainly don't want racial bias to be a reason for sentencing. We don't want gender bias to be a reason for sentencing. We don't want religious bias, and you can imagine how long the list gets. We don't need vindictive justice listed as a negative. Let's stay positive. As a practical matter, in all my years as a prosecutor being in court on probably thousands of sentencings, I never heard a judge refer to vindictive justice, that clause back before 1996. I have, however, since that time, heard judges refer to the positive aspects of the Constitution, and this is what my sentence is based on. Thank you.
Thanks. Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is a question. It's just more of a comment. Nice to see you again, Professor Ballouf.
Nice to see you, Senator.
Thank you. You were talking about how we shouldn't... I'm looking at your written testimony.
Yes.
Do something against the recent will of the people. And I just want to make it clear to everyone that this isn't something that we would do. This is a question that would be referred to the voters. We wouldn't do this, as you know, in the legislature, but instead ask the voters to do that. So I just wanted to clarify that for anyone who might be listening.
If I could respond to that, Senator,
sure.
It would be very unusual to refer to the voters something they approved as recently as 15 years ago to ask them to undo it. Okay. I understand what you're saying, but such casual play with the Constitution is ill-advised.
Understood. And thank you. And just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. And I don't recall the debate at the time that was going on, but in just looking at the information that was given to us in the voters' pamphlet, it seems like most of the focus was on language that was being added, not so much focus on what was being taken out. So I just submit that it's sort of a different question now than it was then.
I would simply repeat my statement that what you are doing is referring something to the people to vote on that has absolutely no effect, that the vast majority of this body thought was ill-advised in the Constitution in the first place, and that the people affirmed that belief by a 66% majority only 15 years ago.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would suggest to use the excuse that, well, we're sending it to voters, it's not our decision, is, in my mind, a really hollow suggestion. If we're referring something to the voters, we're putting our stamp of approval on it. Make no mistake about that. So we are opining on the issue, and we're prejudicing the discussion. And whether that's a constitutional amendment or any of the other things we send out to the people, and I've heard in this building more than once on tax measures and everything else that we send out, well, we aren't making a decision. Indeed, we are by referring it.
Senator Wisnett.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Doug, In your opinion, does the term vindictive, as it modifies justice, connote that the long prison sentence, such as those that are imposed under Measure 11, is somehow vindictive?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Whitsitt, the answer is no. That those long sentences legally, as you've heard Professor Ballou say, are clearly appropriate and constitutional, both Oregon and the United States. So I think the answer is simply no.
The question was on the connotation.
Senator Whitsitt, Chair Prozanski, would you ask the question again then, please?
Certainly. In your opinion, is there a connotation when you modify justice with the word vindictive that long sentences are somehow vindictive?
I think that Professor Ballou wants to say something. As he whispered to
Fair
me.
Enough.
But what I think is that it depends on who the person is as to how that gets answered. I don't find the long sentences to be there. But others might, particularly others in this room who've testified earlier.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on SJR 15? Not seeing anyone. The only other thing I'll close with, I want to thank everyone that came forward today to give their perspectives on the issue. And also for Senator Cruz, just a reminder, this body has, in fact, sent stuff back to the voters after they have supported something just to see if they really meant what they meant. And they have told us many times what they meant is what they said.
With that, we'll close.
All right, we have one.
On a specific reference, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you do. Okay. Yeah, you do. And you were there. Yeah, the records are there.
Absolutely.
All right, so we had, for those who came in late, we were waiting for fiscals to come in on both of the bills. I don't believe we're going to have them before 11 because of. I'm getting there. So 411, it looks like it is going to need to be carried over. And so today is, do you think we'll have them tomorrow? Or do you think that's too quick?
Chairman of the committee, one of the amendments needs further refinement.
All right. Then we're not going to carry over 411. We'll just repost. All right. So it'll probably be reposted for the middle of next week. We need to make certain we have all the amendments there with the fiscals once those are done. Lastly, we do have the fiscal that has come in fact, on SB 95, so I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on SB 95.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 95 comes in from the Oregon Health Authority. The bill prohibits an insurer from not defending a health care practitioner or health care facility against a claim arising from malpractice claim or other negligence claim that is based on disclosure to the patient or the patient's family by the health care practitioner or the health care facility. Chair, members of the committee, you have the dash two amendments in front of you, and they define certain things as patient's family includes within the bill refusal to indemnify, prohibits a policy from containing a provision that excludes coverage based on disclosure, includes a health care institution, a health care facility within the protection offered by the Oregon Patient Safety Reporting Program. Chair, members of the committee, you have the minimal fiscal impact of this bill.
All right, just for clarification, first of all, the dash twos need to be adopted.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
We do not need to worry about the dash ones.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The dash twos supersede the dash ones.
All right. Senator Dingfelder, do you have follow-up?
Was the fiscal also including the dash twos?
Chairman's committee, the fiscal is here. It says to the dash two.
Yeah.
Minimal fiscal.
Yeah,
minimal expenditure.
Yeah, my understanding that was why we're holding back, waiting for the fiscal on the dash twos. We now have that. We know that it is minimal. And so,
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 95.
All right, Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendment in Senate Bill 95. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 95 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 95 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Pisanski. A question for Mr. Taylor. It's my understanding that this admission of culpability, perhaps, is not an admission of liability.
That's correct.
That made it very clear. But is that admissible in court?
Chairman of the committee, I believe it's not.
That's my understanding.
Culpability shouldn't be.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Any other comments or questions? Any objection to the motion? So order. And all right, we're going to have Senator Cruz carry the bill, and I will be in second position if necessary if there's other things that come up. With that, any other work we need to do today? All right, and tomorrow, Thursday, I assume from our conversations we're still on for 8, or we're going to go to 8:30, not 8 o'clock. So that's where I'm going to leave it based on, unless Ms. Ross told you anything different. I think it was next week that we needed to do 8 o'clock. So we'll be back tomorrow, Thursday, at 8:30. We're adjourned.